if the number continues to go down at this pace. Okay, with three very motivated person. So should I start again? Should I start? I think it's okay, yeah?
Pop, pop. Did it stop working?
No, it's working. Okay, so let me remind you what we have done so far. So far, we somehow arrived at the celebrated ADS-CFT conjecture that tells us that a certain gauge theory, which is four-dimensional n equals 4 super young Mills, is dual, so it's equivalent, it's equal, to strings in ADS-5 times S5. So these theories, we know very little about them. The only thing you have seen so far is the metric of ADS-5 and S5. S5 is a sphere, so spheres you know well. But ADS-5 you probably don't know that well. So probably it would be worth studying a bit the geometry of ADS-5, and that's what you are going to do this afternoon. So this afternoon you are going to play with this metric, do some change of variables, try to understand what are the geometrical properties, what is this space that is called anti-de-Sitter space. And in the same way that a sphere has some very nice description once you embedded it in one higher dimension, namely a sphere is the set of points which are equally separated from a given origin, you will see that ADS has an equally beautiful geometrical description also when you embed it in one higher dimension, not as a sphere, but as an hyperboloid. So actually, this spacetime, and of course I don't expect this to be obvious at all, this spacetime has a nice geometrical description. This we will use later on the lectures, and you will see today in the tutorial, as a product of a five-dimensional hyperboloid times a five-dimensional sphere. The dual theory is n equals 4 super young Mills, that I am also assuming that you never saw the Lagrangian of it, but I think Freddy told you that it is the reduction of 10-dimension n equals 1 super young Mills, didn't he? So okay, let me already anticipate that if you work out that reduction, and we are going to do it either today or tomorrow, you will end up with gluons, so we have four, the usual A mu with four components. There will be a theory that will also contain scalars in the adjoint. There will be six scalars, and there will be some fermions that come along, and there are 16 of them, 16 real fermions. And the physical picture, okay, let me not anticipate yet the physical picture. Now, what was the motivation for this duality? So we had already three different pieces of motivation. Of course, all of them very much related. On the one hand, we saw that from the Tuft expansion, if we just have a theory which admits a large number of colors, when we start computing correlation function of, say, three single trace operator, it looks exactly like a scattering amplitude of three strings. So one thing, the first thing that we learned just from drawing these diagrams is that whatever the duality is, there should be a map between a single string and this gauge invariant operators called single trace operators. And indeed, this is the duality, and we will use it again further down the road. So this was one of the motivations. The other motivation was this picture of either doing Feynman diagrams or replacing the Feynman diagrams by a background. And in string theory, this goes by the name of open-closed duality. Namely, if you have some particle passing by some brain, you can all either think of the interaction with the brain as open strings that are propagating and interacting. And open strings are described by super young Mills. So it's, in other words, either you consider interactions governed by super young Mills, or you think of the brain as emitting gluons, and therefore creating an untrivial background. So these two points of view depending on whether you are lying or standing still. Yes. Did someone ask some? Gluons? Going in that direction?
Yeah,
okay. If they go in that direction, this is like an open string that has two ends, I and J, which can end on two different brains, and this I and J are exactly the fields of the gauge theory. It's exactly like a piece of string that is going here. It's exactly like a piece of Feynman diagram. This is the Feynman diagram approach, and this is the background approach, and this field here can be a gluon. Then there was the third argument leading us to this book, and this was by far the most rigorous one, which was this decoupling argument of Malvasina. And the decoupling argument tells us, take a stack of D3 brains, stack them on top of each other, and what you will end up? You will end up with the open strings moving close to the brains, and that's n equals 4 for brain meals, and you will have gravitons and other stuff far away from the brain, and that's 10-dimensional supergravity. Or you can consider the background that some brain, that the brains create. Here is the background. I try to represent this degradé by representing that the background depends on this radial direction. And it is given by some function of the radius, which you obtain by plugging them into the Einstein equation, if you want, that comes from the effect of string action. And this background is a background that interpolates between Minkowski and Angelicita 5. Angelicita 5 when you are close to the brains, and Minkowski when you are far away. So when you are far away, the low energy degrees of freedom are the gravitons and so on. It's 10-dimensional supergravity. When you are close away, because of this redshift, you can have anything. You can have strings in EDS 5 times S5, because from somewhere at infinity, this looks like something very, very light as well. So if you want to match the light degrees of freedom, you cross out gravity, and you end up with a conjecture that n equals 4 is the same as strings in EDS 5 cross S5, which is the content of this conjecture. So now, what we are going to do today is there is still room for more to motivate this duality a bit further. So what we will do today is provide further evidence for the duality, because this duality is a conjecture, so the more evidence we can get, the better. So if we can fill in some more arrows pointing how could we have guessed such strange duality, it's of course better. And we will also make some comments about what this is telling us about quantum field theory and nature in general. Okay, so just about the mapping of parameters. So in the gauge theory, can you read if I write here? Is this a good blackboard to write, or is it better if I use this one? It's fine? Yes? No? Maybe? Gauge theory and string theory. So say we have, for example, we can choose the two parameters to be G and mil square and the toothed coupling lambda, which I remind you is G young mil square times the number of colors. So these are the two independent parameters. It's the same as G young mils and then, but we know that it's very useful to use lambda as a parameter because graphs organize themselves into functions of lambda once I fix the topology. And in string theory, lambda is related to this radius, to this scale parameter in units of alpha prime. So this turns out to be what lambda is. And G and mil square is the other parameter that we have in string theory, apart from alpha prime, which is the string tension, which is the string coupling. Okay? Very good. So for example, the string action will be something like 1 over 2 pi alpha prime integral of some g mu nu that depends on capital X d alpha capital X mu d beta capital X nu times some worksheet metric h alpha beta square root of h. And by this x, I mean the 10-dimensional coordinates. So these are the 10-dimensional coordinates. So if we rescale them so that they become dimensionless, so say we rescale all coordinates, r goes to, so we rescale them in units of this l so that all become coordinates, l times r, x becomes L times X for all possible X's, then what happens is that you will get L squared that will come out because this is proportional to X squared. So then what happens is that this becomes square root of lambda over 2 pi integral of the same action, but now only with dimensionless, variables measured already in the appropriate units. So this is to answer precisely the question by Dalimil that was asking what happens to alpha prime. And you see that in this formulation, you just have dimensionless parameters, that is, you can set L to 1 in that metric, and all that enters is not alpha prime, but alpha prime and this combination of L, which is exactly the Tuft coupling. In other words, remember that I said, formally we take alpha prime to 0, but in reality what we do is consider processes which have energy much smaller than that detected by alpha prime. But here there is one further scale, which is L. So we have L, the energy of what we consider, and alpha prime. So it's perfectly fine to take L over alpha prime to be finite, but the energies in the appropriate units of alpha prime to be very small. So the Tuft coupling appears here. So this is the tension of the string. Okay? Exactly as we had anticipated here. So exactly as we had anticipated, the tension of the string, what measures if it can fluctuate a lot or not, it's exactly square root of lambda. So then let's see already a remarkable feature of this duality. Okay, so this is the dictionary of the parameters. This you can read off from previous, from yesterday's discussion. So let's continue the comparison. This is a bad idea to start writing in this blackboard, right? Let's continue the comparison between what we are getting from the gauge side and from the string side. Suppose we take the limit where lambda is very large. This means huge. Suppose first we take the limit when n goes to infinity. In other words, when g Young mu square goes to 0. Okay? Recall, this is with lambda fixed. So we fix lambda and take n to infinity. So if lambda is fixed, taking n to infinity or taking g and mu to 0 is, of course, equivalent. Suppose we do this limit. What are we doing? So in gauge theory, if we do this, we are studying planar n equals 4 super Young mu. We take only the planar diagrams. Is it clear? We take n to infinity, so the other ones are suppressed. So we take the diagrams with no handles. What happens if we take the diagrams with no handles? It means that the surface we describe, they contain no handles. Right? That's the definition of taking diagrams with no handles. So the strings don't split. And indeed, if G string is 0, if we have no string coupling, they cannot split. So we have what is called free strings. No splitting. I find this word a false friend, because notice that when I say free strings, by no means I'm referring to a trivial theory. It's free in the sense that they cannot split. It's highly quantum in the sense that they can vibrate a lot and the shape can change like crazy. So say if a scattering of 4 strings, you have to sum over all possible surfaces that start on these 2 strings and go to these 2 strings. It's not like they are free or anything in a trivial sense. Yeah? It's clear? So free strings that don't split. So there are no holes. No handles, sorry. No handle. If you have a piece of string, something like this is not allowed. So this is already a simplification. And throughout most of the lectures, if not all the lectures, we will be working in this theory, this limit. It's a very interesting limit for gauge theorists to take this large n limit. And actually, even people who do QCD, if we could solve QCD in the so-called large n limit, so planar QCD, people will be extremely excited. It will be a huge first step. And this large n approximation, even for QCD, where n is 3, turns out to be remarkably good. It really gives the predictions work up to 10% and so on. It's already very, very good. So this is really a great approximation to gauge theories. So this is mostly what we will do. On top of this, suppose we take lambda to infinity, which means huge string tension. Now we have strings that cannot split, and also whose vibration is strongly suppressed. There is a huge tension. You see, 1 over square root of lambda is, so h, it's h bar going to 0. 1 over square root, the inverse of this is what you would call h bar. So it's really the classical limit of strings. So in this case, you will be describing classical strings. Now, are classical strings trivial? Are classical strings trivial? Well, if they are in flat space, yes, they are. You just decompose in modes and choose whatever you want for the modes. Because indeed, in flat space, free strings in flat space are just a free scalar or 10 free scalars. Is this familiar? Bosonic string is just dx dx. It's free scalar. The action, right? And when you write Polyakov action. So free classical strings in flat space are really trivial. But here, we have free strings, so we have to solve the equations of motion for strings that move in this curved background. So it is simple, but not trivial. So classical strings moving in this sphere times this hyperboloid. Or for now, you don't know that it's yet an hyperboloid, but you can imagine that it's moving in the sphere times this spacetime here. So this, let's say, it's easy. This we can do. We can solve the equations of motion for the string in a computer or analytically or whatever. It's easy. But lambda going to infinity on the gauge theory means strongly coupled, a strongly coupled gauge theory. Strongly coupled gauge theory, it's impossible. It's extremely hard. Right? I mean, you cannot do Feynman diagrams. What can you do? Put in a computer? Okay, you can if it's Euclidean. If it's Lorentzian, not even put in a computer. It's really a disaster. So this is very hard. On the one hand, we can take lambda to zero. Lambda to zero means perturbative super Young Mills. Okay, perturbative super Young Mills, we know how to do. I mean, we just start drawing Feynman diagrams, drawing the vertices, doing a couple of integrals. This one is easy. But here, we get highly quantum strings. Strings that can fluctuate like crazy. Strings where the size of the, where the this size here is extremely small. So it's strings like, imagine you put a particle in a very, very, very small box. I mean, he starts moving like crazy due to quantum effects. Extremely quantum strings that can vibrate a lot and whose shape is almost not constrained. And this is, of course, very hard. Extremely hard. So is this good or is this bad? Well, on the one hand, it's spectacular. So it means that we have now an opportunity for studying the hard regimes of theory A by using the easy regime of theory B. So that's awesome. So before we had no way of studying strongly coupled gauge theories, now we just solve some equations of motion for strings in antidesiter. That's super cool. We had no way of studying the highly quantum regime of string theory, but now it is just perturbative gauge theory. So that's really awesome. On the other hand, then it makes it almost impossible to check. So not only the derivation is only a derivation in quotation marks, not only the derivation is not solid at all, and that's why it's a conjecture. So not only we have a hard time proving it, we have a hard time checking it. Because given that the hard regime of one theory is mapped to the easy of the other one, it's almost impossible to check. Yes. Are very hard? And you have to do a path integral where you have strings moving in a curved spacetime. And I mean, this is still a quantum field theory. It's a two-dimensional quantum field theory, but a very quantum one. It's exactly the same reason for why the supreme Mills is hard when lambda is large. It's strongly coupled, right? It's strong coupling. Just because it's strong coupling. It's strong coupling in gauge theory, is weak coupling in string theory, and strong coupling in string theory is weak coupling in gauge theory. So it becomes almost impossible to check, but extremely powerful. And actually, it's great that it's very hard to check. It's great because if it was easy to check, we could disprove it in 10 minutes. Because, I mean, the theory looks so different that only a crazy person could imagine that they would be dual. But they are. And of course, they are because they are. The regime that we know well of one theory is corresponds to the regime that we know very little of the other theory. And that's why such amazing correspondence can be true. So in some lectures that Polchinski gave that I went through when preparing these lectures, he had the exercise at the end of the first chapter saying, find arguments for why a 10-dimensional string theory can never be described by a 4-dimensional gauge theory. And then as a second question, he asks, show why your answer to the previous question is wrong. And indeed, it's very easy to do the first one and not so easy to do the second one. Very good. Okay. So now we'll come back to this, to what are the uses of the ADS-CFT duality from this point of view. But let's first add a few more comments about this decoupling limit. So the first comment is that we used D3s. We used D3 brains because we live in four dimensions. So why not? Let's put some D3s and then we play this game of putting the brain, studying the geometry, taking this decoupling limit, zooming close the geometry, and so on. Of course, we could have taken any other kind of brains. So we can generate many ADS-CFT dualities. Actually, I'm writing ADS, but we should say gravity-CFT dualities. The background doesn't need to be CFT to be ADS. Here it turned out to be ADS. We will actually see when should it come out to be ADS. But in principle, it is gravity. Well, let's replace this. Okay. It's rather gravity gauge dualities. So this decoupling limit is an extremely powerful way of obtaining rigorous dualities between gauge theories and theories of quantum gravity. And if you start putting brains of lower dimensionality, typically you will get simpler gauge theories. You will get gauge theories in three dimensions, in two dimensions, in one dimension, even quantum mechanics, dual to some theory of quantum gravity in higher dimensions. But n equals 4 super young Mills is one of the, somehow, because we live in four dimensions and because it turns out to be a very symmetric gauge theories, probably the most interesting example, or one of the most interesting examples. I would say the most interesting ones are probably n equals 4 super young Mills, because it describes a gauge theory in four dimensions. And the cases that describe gauge theories in three dimensions. Why? Because on the one hand, gauge theories in three dimensions are also very useful, same condensed matter. But also because the gravity dual, as in those cases, is four dimensions, and we live in four dimensions. But OK, let me come back to that a bit later. Actually, exactly now. So notice that we did not get four-dimensional gravity being equal to a four-dimensional gauge theory. No, we got four-dimensional gauge theory being dual to gravity, to a theory of quantum gravity like string theory, in higher dimensions. Okay? So is this totally crazy? Is this something that... So we got more dimensions. So we got gravity in higher dimensions. So the sphere, note that the sphere S5, we can Kaluza-Klein reduce. We can write all fields as modes in the sphere. It's a compact manifold, right? So you can have the zero mode, the first mode, the second mode, and you can Kaluza-Klein reduce. So conceptually, you can more or less ignore the sphere and replace the sphere by all the possible modes of the sphere. Is it clear? Yeah? Is this clear? But not ADS. Not ADS5. So what we got is something. We got at least that four-dimensional gauge theory was dual to 5D gravity. So there was one extra holographic direction that emerged. So this is the usual picture that we say that gravity lives in some space-time, and the gauge theory lives in the boundary of that space-time. Lives at the boundary of that space-time. And the boundary, say, of ADS5, if you take the limit where you go to the boundary of ADS5, so you take ADS5 and take R to infinity, you get dx mu, which is Minkowski space. So when R is very large, go to some very large R, say R equal 10 million, and you get some very large factor times the metric in four dimensions. So four dimensions is the boundary of Ante de Sitter 5. So it looks like we are saying that these four dimensions, which is four-dimensional Minkowski, it's equal to the boundary of these five dimensions, which is ADS5. So we are saying something like gravity, like nature. This is telling us something like nature should be holographic. If you have a description of quantum gravity inside some volume, somehow it can be described by the degrees of freedom in the boundary. Somehow the boundary should know about what happens in the bulk. And indeed, this is the picture. This is consistent or even I could even say something stronger, but certainly consistent, but it's consistent or required. Let's say, by the so-called holographic principle. That I suspect you probably saw in your gravitational physics course, but let me remind you, that tells that the maximum amount of entropy that you can have in a region, suppose we take a region and let this area be equal to A, and here you have some entropy that counts the degrees of freedom, S, then this tells you that the maximum entropy is equal to the area of this region over 4. Tells that you cannot put more degrees of freedom than the area of the surface. So the maximum entropy grows like the area, not like the volume. Have you seen this before? Yes? You did? Should I remind you one heuristic argument of how one could? So imagine, let's do it by reduction of ad absurdum. So imagine otherwise, suppose in this region we have some S which is bigger than A over 4. Okay? Throw stuff inside, say, oh, an apple. Throw lots of stuff inside. At some point, we form a black hole. We have some area. We start putting more and more and more and more stuff. At some point, we form a black hole, somehow, sometime, in some region inside. So at that point, and we have, say, a black hole. But the area, but the entropy of the black hole is equal to the area over 4. So you start with some entropy, you start throwing stuff out, and suddenly the entropy decreases. But that violates the second law of thermodynamics, so that's basically impossible. Therefore, you cannot have more entropy in a given region of space than the area over 4 measured in the appropriate units. So this is quite interesting. So this is precisely compatible with this picture that Antedesiter 5 is a five-dimensional region, and the boundary of Antedesiter spacetime holographically knows everything there is to know about the bulk. Somehow you lose no information by just keeping the dynamics in the boundary. So ADS-CFT is a precise realization of the holographic principle that we need this extra dimension. So I don't know, maybe to deserve one extra arrow pointing to that box, saying holographic principle. Let's one more. Yes. Yes. Yeah. That's right, yeah. That's right. That's exactly correct. Now, let's continue along this line of 4D versus 5D. And let's say that it was good, let's put good in quotation marks, that we did not find a 4D gauge theory being equal to 4D gravity. Suppose we did. Suppose we had, this was what we had encountered, that four-dimensional gravity was four-dimensional gauge theory. Then this would basically mean that gravitons, that are the objects, that the gravitons that mediate gravity, could be thought of as composites, as emergent from a gauge theory. It would mean that the spin 2 particle can be thought of as a bound state of 2 spin 1 gauge fields, say. It would mean that it's possible in a theory without spin 2 to obtain spin 2 fields by taking composites, by constructing them somehow out of the fundamental degrees of freedom of the gauge theory, which are gluons. Is this clear? Now, there is a theorem by Weinberg and Witten that tells exactly that what I have said is impossible. So it's good that we didn't find, otherwise we would have to go argue with them. And they say that, let me see, what's the best way? They show that, so there is a theorem by Weinberg and Witten that says that a QFT with Poincaré invariant stress tensor, like n equals 4 super Young Mills, so we have some stress tensor, T mu nu, forbids fields with J bigger than 1. And they basically, what they do is they show that if you take a particle of spin 2, you compute T mu nu K prime spin 2. Suppose you consider this object. And they show that this object, they start now playing with a Poincaré group and so on, and they show that this object behaves in a crazy way. It will have lots of crazy properties that we will never allow in a physical theory. You can see the paper for more details. So first question you might ask, wait, what about gravity? Gravity is a, can't I write it as a field theory and so on? Yes, but gravity, the stress tensor is zero. Delta S, delta G mu nu is zero. That's how you derive Einstein equations. So gravity evades this because you don't have an non-zero stress tensor. So then you see what happens. So naively, Witten could have said, of course he did not, but he could have said when Tuft proposed this picture that strings, yes. In my notes, I just wrote bigger than one. I think no, actually, but I'm not sure.
I mean, in general, no one, I think, has constructed a consistent spin gaps theory so far. They're all, break unitarity.
So. So you see that you could have said, okay, so suppose I start with some four-dimensional gauge theory here. And now I'm telling you, start with this four-dimensional gauge theory where this is at some point x1, x2, x3, and start drawing all these Feynman diagrams that look like strings. But of course, this is all very unwaving. It's all very vague. And you could say, look, nothing will come out of there because if you will get closed strings, you will get a graviton, but a graviton I know cannot come out, so it's impossible that it will work. So how do you evade this theorem? You evade this theorem because you do get closed strings, but they don't move in the same space-time that the gauge theory does. And that, of course, was not in the hypothesis of this theorem. No one was assuming that you get gravitons, but in a different space-time. So this, if you want, is another thing that we, another hint that we could have used to arrive at this correspondence. So let's indeed write two more arrows. Okay, no, let's not. So there is holography, and there is this theorem of Witten, again, pointing towards the box. So let's use this intuition. Let's suppose we knew that we had holography, and we had Witten's theorem, and wanted to see what could be the dual of four dimension n equals four super Young Mills, which is a theory in four dimensions, which is conformal. I did not tell you, but this is a conformal theory. This theory is conformal. So it's a conformal theory in four dimensions, which contains six scalars and so on. How could we try to go about just using these two blackboards? How could we go about trying to guess what the dual could be? So the first thing we would say is, OK, I need one extra dimension because of these points. So it cannot work in four dimensions. The string theory, whatever it is, must live in five dimensions. So I would immediately say, let's write dx mu, dx mu, and now we will have to add one more dimension to this stuff. So this mu is the original space-time. So this is, let's follow this guessing approach. Of course, we already know the answer, so it's easy to guess. But let's try to follow some logic. So we start with this four-dimensional space-time, 0, 1, 2, 3, and it's a conformal field theory. So scaling x goes to lambda x should be a symmetry. Now, if I rescale this metric, it's not a symmetry. I get lambda square. So this is not a symmetry. How could I make this a symmetry? Let's add. So we add a coordinate z such that underscaling z goes to lambda z. And then let's continue this metric in the simplest possible way, adding one more dimension. We just write dx mu over z square plus dz square. This is the simplest promotion of 4D to 5D. You agree? The first thing that comes to mind, I want to restore this scaling symmetry. X goes to lambda x. I put an extra coordinate that I need anyway. It also scales all coordinates scale because all are dimensionful, and then I get this quantity, right? This is just guessing. Now, if you do z equal L square over R, just a change of variables, this is exactly the metric we derived yesterday. So this is nothing but this metric here. So you see that n to the sitter comes as really the most natural metric that enhances Minkowski by making it, if you want, conformal invariant. Yes? Yeah, this is the metric where you see the field Z. Yeah, this is the metric that I get once I measure my coordinates in units of L. The same metric that you see. Here I have some metric which is dimensionful, and here is dimensionless. If you want, I could put some L square here. Probably, actually, if I do this, there is an L square here. Let's see. Is there an L square here? There should be. So let's do. That should be because I didn't change the dimension. So that is R goes to L square over Z. So there is L to the 4 over Z square. So there is L square still there. Good point. Yeah, I'm on it. Indeed. Then I could still absorb them in the X's and so on. But yeah, very good. But this is exactly the metric we obtain. But then we would say, OK, but this is not a consistent string theory. A string theory cannot live in 5 dimensions. I need 5 more. And they should be compact. So what is the simplest compact space with 5 dimensions? It's a sphere. OK, that's too cheap. Let's do something a bit more sophisticated. We could say that n equals 4 super Young Mill has these 6 scalars. This is a fact. N equals 4 super Young Mill is a theory with 6 scalars. There is an SO6 symmetry that rotates the 6 scalars. So what now? It's simpler. So what is the compact space, which has 5 dimensions, an SO6 symmetry? That's a sphere. That's the only one. So we need, so for a super string, we need ADS5 times some space X of 5 dimensions that needs to have this SO6 symmetry in the same way that this part manifests the conformal symmetry of n equals 4. The other part must manifest this rotation of the scalars among themselves. And the only space which has this symmetry and 5 dimensions is therefore a sphere. So with this simple argument, we would arrive at the conclusion that ADS5 times S5 arises as the simplest possible candidate for the dual of n equals 4 super Young Mills, without any brains, without any anything, without any string, with string theory. So, yes? I'm sorry, one second. Sorry? Because we need to realize all the symmetries of the boundary theory as symmetries of the string theory. And here there is a symmetry. There are 6 scalars. And you can rotate the 6 scalars among themselves. So you need to realize this SO6 symmetry in the compact space. OK, that's it. So by the way, so notice that this ADS is a nice spacetime. So if we have Minkowski 4, this is the gauge theory. And then here we have ADS 5. And now ADS 5, let's write with that metric, which is actually much nicer than the one we found from the brain construction. Dx mu dx mu plus dz square over z square. And here we have just dx square equal dx mu dx mu. When we go to the boundary of ADS 5, I can obtain it by going to some z, going to some epsilon. So let's say z is equal to epsilon, which goes to 0, some very small value. Then this ds square is just proportional to dx mu, dx mu, which is the metric for Minkowski. So in this metric, the picture that we have is that we have a copy of Minkowski at the boundary z equals 0, which is the boundary of ADS. And then we have different copies of Minkowski that are foliated by this z. So as you increase z, you get different copies of Minkowski. Okay. We'll come back to this picture, but this is already a nice geometrical picture of what ADS is. ADS is a set of Minkowski spaces with this rep factor as you go and higher and higher in z. And going higher and higher in z corresponds to applying these dilatations. We'll come back to this in a moment. Yes. Yes. It has constant, yeah.
So the radius of the sphere has to depend on the radius of the area?
It has to be exactly the same radius. And indeed, we saw that the radius, what you would call the radius of ADS, which is L, is exactly the radius of the sphere. You see here, the radius of the sphere is L squared times the radius of the sphere. So here, we have different copies, if you want, of Minkowski. So this is already a space-time where we can have some intuition about. Like space-time plus an extra dimension, and it becomes this smaller and smaller Minkowski. But then, we have the conformal symmetries here. Say x goes to lambda x, and they correspond to isometries here. Symmetries of the space-time. Here it's x goes to lambda x, but then also z goes to lambda z. We have, say, translations. X goes to x plus a constant. And that's just x goes to x plus a constant. And nothing happens to z. Okay? That's kind of obvious. But then what's the scary conformal transformation? What's the nasty one? Special conformal. Special conformal is a pain. I don't even know by heart. Does someone know by heart? Finite special conformal, otherwise I have to get my notes. So x goes to x plus some b mu x square over 1 plus 2 b dot x plus b square x square. And then, this is, again, slightly stronger motivation than this one, x goes to lambda x, and bigger motivation is that this is actually also an isometry of ADS. And it ought to be. It's a symmetry of the boundary. It's a conformal field theory. It ought to be an isometry of ADS. And let me write how it looks like. It's x mu goes to the same thing, x mu plus b mu x square over 1 plus 2b dot x plus b square x square. And then there are some extra terms, plus z square, and here plus z square. So you see that when z goes to 0, when you are approaching the boundary, this isometry of the sitter is becoming just a special conformal transformation. It should, because you are approaching just Minkowski. Otherwise, you have this generalized transformation that takes on the space-time, and it actually also transforms z, goes to z over 1 plus 2b dot x plus b square x square plus z square. So this transformation for a finite vector b is what generalizes a special conformal transformation to an isometry of this ADS5 times S5. Very good. You might want to check it as an exercise that these are indeed isometries of the spacetime, maybe using mathematics. I actually never checked. Because there are simpler ways of understanding it that we will do in a few lectures. But we see already, we already see that starting with some lambda and rescaling it is somehow what you do, what we do in a gauge theory when we go to larger distances. And what does it mean to go to larger distance? Means flow under the renormalization group. So there is yet another picture of what ADS-CFT is. So some people like to think of ADS-CFT as the realization of the holographic group. You start with Minkowski space here, and you have some theory. And as you renormalize, you go higher and higher. And this is, say, the theory after you cross-grained a lot. So some people, for example, I know that many of you are doing a project with Sung-Sik. Who is doing a project with Sung-Sik? So many is one, two. For example, Sung-Sik has been trying to make this idea rigorous. Can we start with some gauge theory, renormalize, so start integrating out the degrees of freedom. Let's introduce a parameter z that tells you how much you have integrated out. And let's try to write the original theory not only as function of space, but also as function of this parameter z. And let's see what we get. Automatically, an extra dimension emerges. And the question is whether we can get something like this holographic direction being something like a renormalization group. So suppose I have some lattice, and then I renormalize the bit, and I have less lattice points. Can I somehow think of this as defining some higher dimension spacetime? So this is the RG direction. So this is another picture that one can use. And you see that if you want to consider, say, the idea is that if you want to consider, say, correlation function at very large distances, you don't care very much about the ultraviolet properties. You will have some strings that propagate, but they will interact roughly in some slice at a given scale. And that's like considering the interaction at a given energy scale. So the further you go, the higher up most of the process will take place. And that's somehow intuitive to this idea of RG. So there are a couple of approaches that are leading to this ADS-CFT picture on top of this one. So on the one hand, we have this idea that, say, of holography. We have the holographic principle. So holography tells us that we need extra dimensions for the gravity theory. On top of this, also in the same direction, we have this theory of Witten and Weinberg that also tell us that also points towards the need of having these strings move in somehow another space-time. Otherwise, everything would be impossible. These two ideas, they become stronger once I say that I need five dimensions that realize scale invariance and five other dimensions that realize the other symmetries. And that's roughly this argument that just hand-waving, very naturally, we arrive at ADS5 times S5 as realizing the conformal symmetry that gives us ADS5, and S5 as realizing the rotation between the scalars. And then, yet another approach that we could follow to try to claim that some extra dimension should emerge is this RG flow picture, where Z is what gives the RG flow. So this extra coordinate Z is what would give us the RG flow. So as I promised, here are lots of arrows, none of them rigorous, but all by themselves, they start to make a very coherent picture that always starts to point towards the same thing, or at least not pointing against it. Yes?
For CFT, so it doesn't depend on the orthogonal direction.
That's right, and that's exactly what we find. We find that as we increase z, we have all of these Minkowski spacetime.
Was the interpretation of the overall scaling changing?
It does almost nothing in a conformal field theory. And that's why you get such trivial spacetime, which is ADS. So that brings me to this slide, to the point that I was saying there. You can use any brains and so on. If the theory that lives on a brain is a conformal field theory, where the evolution in scale is trivial, because there are no scales, the dual must be antecedent. Because ADS is the space that realizes the isometry, as isometry is the symmetry of the conformal group. If the theory, on the other hand, has a non-trivial evolution in scale, then we know that if we put these particles here, or if we put them here, the dynamics is totally different. It's not just 3 scale by 2. So it means that if I put them here, say I have some particle going from here to here, or some particle going from here to here, it cannot be just 3 scale the trajectory of the particle. Because as they go further away, the dynamics should be different, which means that the space-time must change in a more complicated way as you increase z. And then you might try to make this precise and see, can I have space-times that give confinement and so on, and people manage to do it in a phenomenological way by choosing appropriately this dependence in z. So yet another approach that we could take is an axiomatic approach. At some point, when we will work out the dictionary, we will see that the dictionary is the following. For example, if you have z equal to 0, this is the string theory, and you want to compute a correlation function O1, O2, O3 in n equals 4 in the boundary, what you should do is insert some sources in string theory, say some sources at points x1, x2, and x3, that produce some particles or some strings, depends on the energy of these sources, and let them evolve. So let me represent schematically as they evolve, they interact in the bulk. This is the radial direction z. And the claim is that if you do this computation, you put the probes at the boundary, but let them evolve in the bulk and compute what you get, this gives you a prediction for the strong coupling regime of the gauge theory. That is, if you want to study weak coupling, you don't do this. You do the computations in the boundary with usual Feynman diagrams and so on. But if you want to do the computation at strong coupling, what you do is you use one extra dimension, and that gives you the strong coupling result. Okay? But then we can say, okay, let's do the following. Let's imagine I put string theory in ADS5 times S5. And I consider these processes where I put 3 sources and I get some number. And let's say that this defines what I say it's a correlation function in the boundary. Right? So I put some sources, I study how it evolves, and I say this is the definition of a correlation function between these 3 points. This will define some correlation functions that only depends on points in the boundary. So then you might ask, okay, does this correlation function that come from this definition obey all the axiomatics that a quantum field theory needs to obey? Does this define a quantum field theory in the boundary? Does this define, in particular, a conformal field theory in the boundary? Right? If it does, then okay, the conjecture becomes, in a sense, empty. It works because it's a definition, not a conjecture. Right? But then you could say, okay, suppose it does define axiomatic, suppose it obeys all the axioms of quantum field theory. And actually, there has been a huge amount of progress in showing that it does by people like Polchinski, Juan Penedones, and others. Suppose it does. Then you could say, okay, I have string theory in ADS5 times S5. It defines some gauge theory. Some gauge theory by these rules, by studying putting strings at 3 points and seeing how they evolve and so on, and getting a number. What theory could this be? But then you see, okay, it must be a theory. This is the symmetry in the bulk. In particular, when I go to the boundary, I must get this symmetry. So it must be a conformal symmetry. I have these rotations of the scalars. Must be a conformal symmetry with this rotation between with this SO6 symmetry that rotates the scalars. If I would do it with the fermions for the string theory, I would conclude that it must be a theory in 4 dimensions, which is conformal, which has n equals 4 supersymmetry. How many theories there are which are conformal and have n equals 4 supersymmetry in 4 dimensions? Only one. It's n equals 4. So then you would conclude that ADS-CFT must be true. Where is the caveat? Why is this not a derivation? It could be that, say, at some point it becomes very hard to use string theory as a definition because string theory itself is not very well defined beyond usual string perturbation theory. But model this caveat, this is almost a proof that it ought to work. Conversely, and more interesting in my opinion, there has been a lot of very interesting works in using the gauge theory, because that one is really well defined, as a definition, again, for that you need a dictionary, as a definition of quantum gravity. And then you can use n equals 4, or you can use other conformal field theories or other field theories as a definition through this dictionary of what you mean by quantum gravity. So let me see. What did I think I covered already most of it. So do I have? I have a few minutes, right? I'm almost not over time. So sorry. Okay. So let's conclude. Let's make a brief summary. Because now next time we will, I'm done with motivating ADS-CFT, and next time we'll really start learning about n equals 4 and about strings in ADS-5, and we will really start studying theory A and theory B. So we see that ADS-CFT, let me just summarize what I have said by words, has at least three different, we can see it with three different eyes. So on the one hand, we can use this as, if you want, a definition of the field theory. Definition of the gauge theory. So we can use this to define the gauge theory. We just specify some rules for the gravity theory, and this defines the gauge theory. And this has two main applications, if you want. One is a more phenomenological, if you want, which is the approach of, say, ADS condensed matter, ADS QCD, or ADS quark gluon plasma, or ADS QCD, or ADS Rigg physics, which is the same as gluon plasma, so okay. This approach is to anti-sitter for studying problems of high energy scattering, or ADS high energy scattering, ADS condensed matter, and so on, are exactly in this category. You start with a simplest possible anti-sitter. You don't even care if it's a string theory. You just write some gravity in ADS, and then suppose you want to study some theory which contains charged objects, so you put some gauge field. And you just study gravity coupled to some gauge field in anti-de-Sitter space, some very simple phenomenological model. Then you use these rules of computing correlation functions and see what this defines for you as correlation functions. And then you try to see, are these the correlation functions of a superconductor or of a quantum Hall effect and so on. And you try this more phenomenological approach of starting with a simple ADS model that we know will describe a strongly coupled regime of a gauge theory that we don't know what it is. And we use this from this more phenomenological point of view. Or we can use it, if you want, from a more fundamental point of view, as I said, Panadonis or Polchinski or Witten when he proposed the dictionary, when he proposed that this is the dictionary. This here is by Witten. It's in one of the references that are in the wiki now. More fundamental point of view, where you try to see that you do get a good CFT that obeys all the properties and so on, and you try to explore the space of conformal field theories by also exploring the space of quantum gravity theories. You can use it as a definition of quantum gravity. Okay, a definition of quantum gravity. You say that I have some gauge theory. For example, n equals 4 supreme mu is a very precise one. Should be dual to whatever happens in the bulk with respect to quantum gravity. And this is extremely powerful. So, for example, there can be no black hole information paradox. which is the paradox that tells you that you start throwing stuff at a black hole, that you start with, say, a pure state, then it radiates at some finite temperature, so at the end you get a mixed state and you lost information. Because if the boundary theory is really a unitary quantum field theory, whatever the description of throwing stuff at a black hole and so on corresponds to, is dual to a unitary evolution in the boundary. So it might be complicated to understand from the gravity point of view what's going on, but there can be no information paradox because, say, n equals 4 super young mills is, of course, unitary. We can use this to explore explore the moduli of conformal field theories, explore families of conformal field theories, and therefore learn about possible theories of quantum gravity. For example, n equals 4 super young mills contains many fields, many operators, which have very small anomalous dimensions. As we will see, anomalous dimensions are dual to energies of the states of the quantum gravity theory, so energies of strings. Having light anomalous dimensions means that you have light strings. For example, you have gravitons. But in n equals 4, you have many light modes, so you don't have only gravitons in the dual theory. And indeed, you have supergravity. You don't have gravity. So you have gravity plus a bunch of other fields related by supersymmetry that also behave like gravitons, gravitinos, and many other stuff. So you could ask yourself, so one good feature of conformal field theories is one where I have a very small number of fields that have low dimension, because those will correspond to graviton and other few modes. And everyone else must have high dimensions, and they must be dual to excited modes and black holes and so on. So, for example, if you would like to describe just pure gravity, you would need to have just one state which would be dual to the graviton with a zero anomalous dimension. So by exploring the moduli of CFTs with hierarchy, all this I will explain in detail, with hierarchy of deltas is equivalent to exploring the different possibilities for quantum gravity. And provided we have a good dictionary, I do think that ADS-CFT gives us a framework for understanding all questions of quantum gravity. Of course, I'm not saying that quantum gravity as defined by string theory is, of course, the theory of nature, but I'm saying that all questions you might ask in quantum gravity are solved by ADS-CFT. Here is a theory that can, in principle, explain everything. Hawking radiation, black hole information paradox, all processes in quantum gravity, unless they involve cosmology. Then it becomes much harder. But then, and this is the point of view that we will follow, in these lectures, it can provide, if you want, important hints for solving string and gauge theories. So we know that we have this duality between n equals 4 and string theory. We know that n equals 4 is hard when string theory is easy and vice versa. So how can we check this duality? This comes to the very first point of the lecture. How can we ever check this duality? Well, now that we have ADS-CFT, the exercise of computing stuff in gauge theory becomes one of those exercises that we all like when we have an exam, which is show that something is true. It's much simpler than derive this. So ADS-CFT tells you, so this operator should have this dimension when you go to strong coupling. Now compute it in gauge theory. You say, but I only have Feynman diagrams. OK, you have to develop something better, but at least you know what the result should be. So go home, think hard, and try to solve a gauge theory. And this has been extremely fruitful. And by using this ADS-CFT, one has made enormous progress that would be unthinkable before of understanding gauge theories and string theories at any value of the coupling, going well beyond perturbation theory. And my hope, and the hope of many people, is that this understanding better ADS-CFT and how this duality works will ultimately lead to different frameworks for defining quantum field theories, that will render Feynman diagrams and the usual perturbative techniques obsolete. Because really, ultimately, that's what we need. That's what we need. We cannot live with Feynman diagrams much longer. I mean, already most computations that we do, the most advanced computations already don't use Feynman diagrams in the way that you learned in your course. They already use unitarity methods and other stuff that Freddy can tell you more about. But we need even better. We need to push the limits of how we define gauge theories and string theories. And ADS-CFT provides an awesome laboratory for pursuing this quest of improving our understanding of theoretical physics in that aspect. So what do we need to do next? What are we going to do now? So we need to know, so this is what we are going to do in the next lecture. So we need to know more about N equals 4 super young Mills. What is this theory and so on? So that's what I will do tomorrow. Write the Lagrangian, write the Feynman rules if you want, and so on. We need to know more about ADS-CFT. We need to know more about ADS-5. ADS-5, we start to have some handle on the geometrical meaning of ADS-5, but clearly we need to play a bit more to start feeling a bit more how it works. That's what you are going to do today in the tutorial, and then we will come back to this in a week or so. Then we need to establish a dictionary. So we need, now we will always take that box as our starting point. So of course we need a dictionary. And then we need checks. And this is, of course, the hard part, but also the interesting and the challenging one that we will do in this lecture. We need to be able to check this somehow. So we will need to perform computations at any coupling or whatever. That will be the exciting, one of the exciting parts. So this is a short term. So this we'll do tomorrow, today during the tutorial. We will start establishing a dictionary tomorrow. And basically, the next 2 weeks, starting already tomorrow and during most of the next week, we will be discussing what are called non-local observables in gauge theory, like scattering amplitudes and Wilson loops. And starting at the end of the next week and during the last week, we will discuss local observables in gauge theories, such as correlation functions. Okay? And for both of those quantities, we'll learn how to compute them in gauge theory, how to compute them in string theory, and what is the dictionary. OK, so are there questions? Nothing? So again, I hope you are not intimidated by this picture. I hope that having many not solid derivations is better than having just one of them. But I hope that I convinced you that all evidence points towards this conjecture. Would you like me to expand on one of these points a bit further tomorrow? I can prepare something if you want. Otherwise, we will now close the hand-waving chapter and start doing the serious work, in quotation marks. The holography argument? Okay, I can think a bit about. Maybe I will tell you in private because that's really on the direction of black holes and so on, that it's very orthogonal to what I'm going to do next.
I would be fine with that.
Okay. I mean, for now, I will be happy to do it a bit later, but for now, let me then just emphasize what I did here. So here, we have some symmetry of this spacetime. If you plug this symmetry into the metric goes back to itself. So this is a symmetry that if you act on the spacetime, it leaves the spacetime invariant. In particular, you can ask what, so it sends points to points, but the total spacetime is the same. What happens when you are approaching the boundary? You generate a special conformal transformation. You generate exactly the transformations that you need to, that are symmetries of a conformal theory. So if you have a theory of gravity that has this symmetry, which is an enlarged symmetry, this theory of gravity will lead to a theory at the boundary that must have this symmetry. But this is a symmetry of conformal theories. So conversely, if I have a symmetry of conformal theories and want to promote it, it's very hard to come up with something that is not this. Actually, it's impossible. This is the only space which has the isometries of the conformal group. Now, how would you prove that this is the only space? Say, for a sphere, it's very simple. It's very intuitive that the sphere has this SO6 symmetry, and that's it, right? So the sphere, if you have an object which has SO6 symmetry, then it's clear. You put a point, apply SO6 transformations, you generate a sphere. So of course, the sphere is the compact object which has this SO6 symmetry. So the way to show that ADS is the only space with this conformal symmetry is by first remembering that the conformal group is also SO2,4. This you studied in the CFT course, I guess, no? What is SO2,4? SO2,4, instead of rotation, is now, instead of six-dimensional rotation, is Boost's, is Lorentz group in a six-dimensional space-time with a signature 2,4, instead of rotations of signature 6. Okay, so it is like rotations with a different signature. What is the analog of a sphere with this different signature? It's an hyperboloid. So once you write the hyperboloid, which is really the analog of a sphere with two minus signs, because it comes from flipping the signature in two directions, then it's clear that the hyperboloid is the space that has this SO2,4 symmetry. But this SO2,4 is exactly the conformal group. So by working out the relation between that hyperboloid and these coordinates, which by the way have an important name, these are Poincaré coordinates. This is the ADS in Poincaré coordinates. By working out the relation, by showing that they are related, then this is what you are going to do today, you show that ADS is the spacetime which realizes as isometries the symmetries of the conformal group. Yes? No? Was it slower today? I'm going to give up. Was it slower? No? It was not, it was not fast, good. Thank you.